white graphics on a black background. Showtime Documentary Films presents Atara Films and Ardmaka Productions co-production.
All right, I gotta tell you, I'm real proud to introduce this next artist whose name's become synonymous with courage and integrity. Ladies and gentlemen, Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor steps on stage. Smiling self-consciously, she holds the microphone and briefly averts her gaze from the audience. With elfin features under a tight buzz-cut hairstyle, she stands completely still, now staring impassively at the huge crowd. There is a montage of images spanning Sinead's career, from promotional music videos, live performances, rehearsals, and news footage. It includes a woman having her hair cut short, Roman Catholic iconography, Sinead ripping up a photograph of Pope John Paul II on Saturday Night Live. Directed by Catherine Ferguson. Still at the microphone, Sinead again bends her head, seeming thoughtful, then steps to one side and starts to pace up and down, head lowered, waiting. None of the interviewees in this film appear on camera. Sinead O'Connor.
I didn't mean to be strong. I wasn't thinking to myself, I must be strong. I didn't know I was strong. I did suffer through a lot because everybody felt it was okay to kick the shit out of me. I regret that I was so sad because of it. I regret that I spent so many years very lonely and isolated, really.
Nothing compares. Archive footage. Sinead performs live.
There was no therapy when I was growing up, so the reason I got into music was therapy, which is why it was such a shock for me to become a pop star. It's not what I wanted. I just wanted to scream.
Live footage of Sinead, face contorted, mouth wide open, screaming into a microphone.
Everybody in music has a story in terms of their upbringing or where they came from or what they went through. There's something they need to get off their chest, and perhaps we all need a bit of love and affection that we didn't get anywhere else, but we get by making music.
Sinead appears on The Late Late Show.
We're all looking at you, Sinead, out there on television, and they're saying, Mother of God, what did she do with our head? Isn't that a disgrace? I hope my daughter wouldn't turn out like that. Isn't that what you're saying? Yes, you are already. You are. How are you then?
I'm fine.
Well done so far. Now, from Glenageary. You were a difficult child, Sinead O'Connor. You were difficult growing up. You went through a lot of schools, did you not?
I think quite a few at the expense of my father.
How many schools did you go through and why?
About five or six.
How many schools did she go through?
I'd say no more than five or six.
Five or six.
I think it's a bit exaggerated, actually. That's in 1 year, of course.
And for me, some scarlet ribbons. Scarlet ribbons for my head.
My very first musical memory is my father singing to me Scarlet Ribbons.
I just remember being blown away. Like, I remember, like, yesterday lying on my pillow and my dad singing this song to me, and I was like, oh my God, the angels came in the window. All the streets
were dark. When I'm 11, my brother comes home with Slow Train Coming, which completely changes my life and makes me want to be a musician and makes me want to be an artist and makes me know what kind of artist I want to be because of the song Gotta Serve Somebody. And I was obsessed with Bob Dylan from then on.
Archive footage of Bob Dylan. Then a teenage girl takes a record from its sleeve.
My mother had this fantastic record collection that which she would spread out on the dining room table every morning, like a deck of cards. Her musical tastes ranged from John Lennon right through awful kind of HMS Pinafore light opera, right through to like Porgy and Bess. And also in those days, musicals were huge. That was all that was ever on telly, was these just high-class musicals, you know? And my mother always had the soundtracks to them. My father was into cello, which I used to find just too sad, given our circumstances.
My parents separated when I was quite young. My mother was a very violent woman, not a healthy woman. Mentally at all. She was physically and verbally and psychologically, spiritually and emotionally abusive.
My mother was a beast, and I was able to soothe her with my voice. I was able to use my voice to make the devil fall asleep. My father is the type of man that didn't want anyone talking about what happened, and that's what was wrong with me. It wasn't talked about even in the family.
The cause of my own abuse was the church's effect on this country, which had produced my mother. I spent my entire childhood being beaten up because of the social conditions under which my mother grew up, and under which her mother grew up, and under which her mother and her mother grew up. I would compare Ireland to an abused child.
A montage includes black and white footage from 1967's Rocky Road to Dublin by Peter Lennon. School children walk accompanied by a priest in a long black soutane. An altar boy lights a candle. A bishop in robes holds a crozier. Statues of Christ, rosary beads. People walk past a church holding prayer books.
I began studying scriptures when I was very small, because I wanted to see what was in this book that they were using to oppress my people. Why were my grandparents so miserable that they couldn't have a kiss without feeling like they were going to burn in hell?
Pilgrims walk barefoot up the steep slope of Croagh-Patrick. Priest Father Brian Darcy.
The church influenced everything. If it was a sin, then it was against the law of the state. So divorce, contraception, and anything that didn't agree entirely with a very narrow view of the Catholic Church, it was simply not allowed. It affected every level of society. It was a mortal sin, for example, to go to a dance in some diocese that didn't end at midnight. It was a mortal sin to eat meat on a Friday. You could go to hell for eating a sausage on a Friday. Everything was gathered around the power of the church over its people.
I had loved the Catholic Church. I had grown up so religious, like stupidly religious. But I made my Holy Communion and I took it seriously. That was a contract with the Holy Spirit I made. And I believed it all, and I was trying to live it.
A photo of Sinead as a child in her white First Communion dress. Then, a stern-faced elderly nun peers from a shadowy building.
I went into care when I was 14, into care home, for want of a better description. I was a bit messed up, and it wasn't acknowledged what had happened to me in my mother's house. I was unmanageable, really, so they didn't want me at home. The place was called An Ghrianon, which means the sunrise.
An Ghrianon was a residential training centre run by a religious order, by sisters. The girls came from mixed backgrounds. Some had come from other children's homes, had been in care all their lives. Others had come from insecure family settings, and they needed somewhere where there was structure and safety for a few years.
They got a guitar teacher in who was the loveliest woman alive, who I still know and I still talk to now and then. She's bloody lovely. If not for her, I wouldn't have made it through that place.
The first night I was there doing music with the girls, I asked her, would she like to sing a song for us? And I won't forget it as long as I live, because we were just stunned. We needed to encourage her in this wonderful talent.
Music teacher Jeanette Byrne. Video footage of Jeanette Byrne's wedding.
When we decided to get married, I asked Sinead then to do the solo, and she sang Evergreen, which was my favourite song. The emotion of the song almost brought people to tears. It was stunning. It was absolutely stunning.
In the congregation was her brother, Paul Byrne, and then he was forming this band called Into Anua.
Paul Byrne.
We were searching for a singer, so when I heard this voice, it stopped me in my tracks. After chatting with Sinead on the steps of the church, I'd arranged to go up and see her at On Green On. We gave her a tape, and she phoned the next day. She had the lyrics and the melody done. So we went back up the next night, and she sang it to us, and it was spectacular. We had to book a couple of hours on a Wednesday afternoon, because Sinead got a half day from school on a Wednesday. Picked her up, did 2 hours of vocals with her, and then had her back before the nuns noticed she was missing.
The first song that I wrote, which became their first single, was called Take My Hand. It was a result of the punishment. The nun meted out to me one day. The nun, she could be terribly kind, but she could also be terribly cruel as well. Where I was attached to a Magdalen laundry. She sent me to sleep in the hospice part of the laundry as punishment a couple of times, to remind me that if I didn't behave myself, I was going to end up like these women. When I went up, there was no staff there with the ladies. There was never any nuns or nurses. And the poor ancient ladies, who were the Magdalen girls, were lying in their beds calling out for nurses all night that never came. It was awful. I didn't know what to do, and obviously I was terrified.
Black and white footage of women in a Magdalen laundry, all wearing identical drab uniforms of baggy dresses and shirts. Jeanette Byrne.
These women we're now talking about, the early 80s, some of them had been there from the 1920s. These women who, through no fault of their own, had just been put in by the courts and by men. Very often the cases were they had been raped by maybe the local priest, the doctor, the father, or some pillar of society. They had to pay the price and were locked away for their whole lives.
The whole of Ireland talks about these ladies, but I met them. I met them at their most vulnerable. These people convinced my father that they could help me with whatever behavioural issues I had as a result of what had happened to me growing up. But they didn't. They just shut the door in his face when he dropped me there. They took his money. The problems were compounded. We all were walking around thinking we were terrible people who didn't deserve to live. My father, I'm sure the world would acknowledge, deserves a refund.
A photo shows Sinead as a teenager with conventionally short dark hair combed to the side. Then a caption reads, Dublin, Ireland, 1984. Archive footage teenage fashions, punks, goths, skinheads, concert posters for the Virgin Prunes and The Alarm. Sinead's friend, Clodagh Latimer.
Sinead and I met when we were both around 18 years old. We were very close for a number of years until life kind of took us in different directions. She really wanted to be doing her music. I feel she really knew what she wanted to do, but I don't quite know if she knew what path it would take her on.
I put an ad in Hot Press magazine that I was a singer and I wanted to find a band to join. And I remember going into these suburban houses doing auditions for these various different bands. Eventually, I ended up meeting this dude called Colm Farrelly. He was putting together this band, Tonton McCoot. So I became the singer in that band. I had a job at the Badass Cafe in Crown Alley, and we used to rehearse right across the road from it. We did nothing but rehearse live, which is why I love live performing. And every rehearsal was like a gig. Nigel Grange and Chris Hill came over to Dublin to see us, Tonton McCoot. About 6 months later, my mother unfortunately died, very selfishly. Months after that, I get a phone call from Chris and Nigel, and he said, well, why don't you come to London and do some demos?
A montage, an onboard view as a tube train enters a station. Margaret Thatcher, an anti-apartheid march, tickets for the Live Aid concert, the Notting Hill Carnival. Then archive footage of Sinead rehearsing with a band. A caption reads, London, England, 1985. Keyboardist Mike Clowes.
I worked with Sinead from her arrival in London through to the development of and the recording of her first album, Lion and the Cobra. Our job as a sort of group of musicians from the outset was to help her to find her feet. She'd already found her voice, but she wanted to find the sort of musical clothing that she wanted to wrap around that amazing voice.
What's it called?
So we went into a rehearsal studio in Putney and started to routine the songs and get used to dynamics and arrangements. It makes a big difference if you can go in and rehearse for a long time.
Drummer John Reynolds.
Nigel Grange was the head of Ensign at the time. He was quite used to putting people into a position of being able to work for long periods. So he was a kind of a nurturer. The first time I heard Sinead's voice was just unbelievable. It was jumping octaves and going from whisper to scream in half a second. I mean, it was just amazing. Young kid from Dublin, you know.
Photographic contact sheets show a smiling Sinead with a mop of dark hair.
You often hear artists saying that they're channeling something. I think actually you're channeling yourself. Your subconscious is talking to you. I just had these songs inside me that had to come out.
They were very, very personal, and they were sort of cathartic, really. They were kind of songs to help her, to heal her.
In some respects, I think the band that we were, the band of musicians who were around her, were something of a family for her. We were safe.
A photo shows the band members holding a reclining Sinead in their arms.
Wagner O'Kelly had been Boomtown Rat's manager and had run U2's label. He came over to London and became Sinead's manager.
D-D-C.
I had a great time hanging out with Faulkner, and Faulkner used to bring me to Portobello Road on Saturdays, where he had his friend Lepke, Leroy, used to have the Dread Broadcasting Company, and they had the open mics. Bear in mind, I'm Irish and I've come from the theocracy. And these guys were coming along roaring about the Pope as the devil and fucking burn the Vatican and all this stuff. So that was like, oh my God, I'm home. I couldn't believe it. So I fell in love with Rasta at that point.
Love to everyone. You're back in tune to the Rankin Miss P on DBC, the Dread Broadcasting Corporation. 103.8 every Friday. You can't see. We're electric, yeah.
A photo of a young white man with short dark hair and stubble. Drummer John Reynolds.
She was really shy and she was, you know, living down in East London with her auntie. She didn't know anyone. And so we just hung out. We did a lot of driving around London, you know, with the stereo on. Just having a great time, actually. Just being kids, to be honest.
Keyboardist Mike Clowes.
Ensign wanted Sinead to be a musical commodity.
They wanted me to grow the hair long and wear short skirts and high heels, makeup and the whole works, write songs that wouldn't challenge anything. But then I come from a country where there used to be riots in the streets over plays. That's what art is for.
That led to her deciding to shave off all her hair.
In Reconstruction, a woman shaves her head with an electric razor. Friend, Clodagh Latimer.
At the time, I was her closest female friend, I think. I went to see some friends, and when I got back to her flat, she wouldn't open the door. She just said, I can't. You've got to look through the letterbox. I've done something, and you're going to kill me. I looked through the letterbox, and there she was, with a completely shaved head.
Archive footage of Sinead with her number one style haircut.
The label were trying to brand Sinead with those really obvious generic female labels. Obviously, she was having absolutely none of it. You just looked at somebody and went, we know now that what we're dealing with. It's a powerful statement for a woman because she says, don't fuck with me.
Me and John were friends for a year before, you know, we ever went out with each other. We were both going out with different people and everything. And then we just kind of drifted into it. And then within a month, I was pregnant.
A photo, Sinead shows off her bump.
The record companies in those days had their own doctors that they sent you to. The doctor announces that the record company have spent £100,000 making your record. You owe it to them not to have this baby.
Ensign tried to dissuade her from carrying on the pregnancy and giving birth to Jake. And thankfully, she obviously stood her ground, but they did put pressure on her to terminate the pregnancy.
That was the final straw for me. I was sick of the fucking record anyway. I hated the fucking record.
There was a big fallout. Faulkner O'Kelly was working very hard to persuade the label to just give her scope, to just change tack. Basically, they said, have a go.
In my part, it was a response to them telling me I owed them not to have my baby. You know, I was like, well, it ain't worth it for a shit fucking record. I just knew I didn't want any man telling me who I could be or what I could be or what to sound like. I came from a patriarchal country where I'm being told everything I can and can't do because I'm a girl. I'd figure, well, if I didn't take it from the system and I didn't take it from my daddy, I ain't taking it from anybody else.
In a recording studio.
Whole of the Lion and Cobra was completely scrapped and we started again. That was a really important turning point in that record. The second version was fresher, younger and spontaneous.
how we got the first album cover. I was frozen like a rabbit in the headlights getting my picture taken. Put on the album and got me to scream along with the album. So that's why there's the picture of me, looks like I'm screaming, which they wouldn't use in America because it was too aggressive looking as far as they were concerned.
I didn't realise that they'd have to do a different one for America. It was only when it came out and I thought, yeah, of course, they couldn't have a picture of her screaming. You know, that would scare too many people. I had to photograph her for the cover from shoulders up because the record company didn't want to see her pregnant. Once we had got the pictures that we knew the record company needed, we just did what we wanted. It was, you know, a joy to photograph this little girl with her bald head and her big belly. Amazing looking.
I think her image screamed more than feminism, beyond feminism at the time. I think it was this, like, non-binary, incredible, intersectional feminist attitude. Her fashion sense was like 35 years ahead of the time.
Musician Peaches.
People found it problematic just because they read the language of skinhead into the shaved head. It suggested some kind of aggression, but actually the beauty of her features, the quality of her eyes, it created a fantastic contradiction. As a filmmaker, it gave me a very graphic, powerful image from the get-go.
Any time I worked with John Mabry, it was amazing because he came with a whole gang of glorious queens. The set makers, you know, the stylists, the makeup people, you know. And they, like, genuinely adored me.
Sinead steps on stage in front of an audience, many of whom are in drag.
I felt so safe and looked after, you know what I mean? I felt like I had, like, 100 daddies.
She recognised in us kind of a sense of some kind of kindred spirit. But there was no judgment, there was no critiquing in any kind of personal terms, and she was free to be who she wanted to be within that, because everyone else was free to be who they wanted to be.
I had never, until I went to London, seen gay people. They were so inspiring and still are to me, especially the ones that were dressing like women. You couldn't do that in Ireland, you could have the shit kicked out of you, you know?
An archive interview.
Why I like performing and why I like singing loud and stuff like that is because I am quietly spoken and quite withdrawn into myself in my sort of normal life, so it's quite a release to me to climb on a stage and scream for an hour. At the end of the night.
Songs that I've written about my mother's death or in response to her death. And Troy, I think, was the first one. It's also the first song I've wrote where I'm telling anybody about anything that's happened.
I remember it. And ducking in a rainstorm. And sitting in the long grass in summer. Keeping warm.
One of the very traumatic things that happened to me growing up was that my mother had me living in the garden. So once when I was 8 and a half, I lived in the garden 24/7 for a week or two. I'm talking in that song about that experience, the whole thing of sitting in the long grass in summer, trying to keep warm. So I'm out in the garden in the fucking dark, and when it's coming to dusk, and I still hate dusk to this day, I don't mind if it's day or night, but dusk I don't like. And I'd be looking up at the only window at the side of the house where she'd have a light on, and I'd be screaming, begging her to let me in, and she wouldn't let me in, the light would go off, the house would go dark. Every other song I'm writing is about somebody else or from the point of view of somebody else. Troy's the first song I've written about me. It's not a song. It's a fucking testament. Troy is not safe. I don't need to dig that up again. It's like trauma therapy. There would have been no point writing and or going around the world screaming Troy into microphones if there wasn't going to come a day one day that I didn't need to do that anymore.
Make no difference what you say. You're still a liar. You're still a liar.
A photo. Sinead smiles as she holds a baby.
Sinead was pregnant all through the making of The Lion and the Cobra. And I think in many ways, actually, it was quite grounding to have a baby very young. In some way, I think it probably kept us sane. There's nothing more deep and real than a baby. And there's nothing more fake and unimportant than fame, really.
First appearance on Top of the Pops. Here's another lady making her first appearance. She's got an excellent new album out at the moment called The Lion and the Cobra and a single Mandinka at 22 in the charts. This is Sinead O'Connor.
I remember watching Sinead on Top of the Pops. It just seemed quite surreal, to be honest, because she was just my friend, but she was this other person in other people's eyes.
John Reynolds.
When Mandinka was released, it just jumped out of the radio. It was one of those songs.
Musician John Grant.
You know, it was almost like she had always been there once she came on the scene, because you really couldn't imagine your life without her at that point. I heard Mandinka at a club in Boulder, Colorado. I just remember hearing the voice, and it's nothing other than something that stops you in your tracks. I hear that voice, and I feel comforted. And that first album, like, the entire thing was just stunning.
Music journalist Bill Coleman.
The Lion and the Cobra was an amazing album just because there was no filler on it. So as a critic, you know, that was one of the first things that drew me to it. She also has a very singular voice and perspective and very strong personality-wise. To me, it was like the whole package.
Publicist Elaine Schock.
The thing about The Lion and the Cobra is you don't get that as a debut album every day. Those things come like once in a lifetime.
And many times in your performances, there's an intensity, almost a rage burning inside of you. Where does that come from? You're a small, demure, quiet sort of person.
I don't know. Perhaps there's something twisted about me that I haven't realized yet.
You've also said that non-traditional Irish musicians seem to have to leave Ireland to make it.
If you're a woman in particular, unless you're very sort of timid and you want to make nice Irish music, which I respect and everything, life can be very difficult for you because people can't actually handle a woman doing anything different.
Archive footage of women playing harps.
When I leave Ireland, it's virtually unheard of for a woman to be making her own living and independent of men.
The Irish fucking constitution still contains the wording that a woman's place is in the home.
So I was very lucky from 1985, I was making my own living. So many people in this country, women in particular, had to say no when they wanted to say yes to themselves or be open about their anger. At that time in Ireland, women weren't allowed to be angry. And I think that might have been hard for some of them because, you know, they had spent their whole life saying no to themselves.
Tonight, the Grammy Awards are presenting Best Rock Vocal Performance Female. Our first performer is 21 years old, comes from Ireland, and with her very first album, The Lion and the Cobra, she has served notice that this is no ordinary talent. Ladies and gentlemen, please meet Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead steps on stage at the 1989 Grammy Awards, Los Angeles, USA, wearing blue jeans, a black crop top, and with a Public Enemy logo painted on the side of her head.
I'm dancing with seven veils. Want you to pick up my style. See how the black moon fades. Soon I can give you my heart now.
I remember talking to her the next day and she said, oh my God. I went on stage as Stevie Wonder was sitting in the front row. And we were all Stevie Wonder freaks. So this was quite a leap, you know.
You know, you're there and you're looking. looking at all these people that you've sort of watched on the television, and there's people like Quincy Jones and Steve Wonder and all that, and I was just like,
sang Mandinka with Jake's baby girl in the back of my pants, and I had Public Enemy's logo painted into the side of my head. They decided they wouldn't go to the Grammys, quite rightly, because they were protesting.
I protested the Grammys in 1989 because they refused to recognize rap music and hip-hop as a legitimate musical category. I thought it was, like, admirable when she put the Public Enemy logo in her head. With Sinead O'Connor, you didn't get the sense that she was just being pretentious or she was fake. It was like, yeah, she seriously has issues with this. This is what's going to drive her artistry. She's committed to that.
Rapper Chuck D of Public Enemy. Publicist Elaine Shock.
It was a brilliant performance. At that point, she was the darling of everyone.
In one way, I loved it. Obviously, I was a very young woman, and you kind of fantasize about being famous. In another way, I was frightened by it. What maybe was difficult for me was the timing of the success thing. It meant that I suddenly had this identity, I didn't feel like it was really me. To be honest, I also had very little self-esteem. I couldn't understand why anyone liked my records.
Sinead appears on a chat show.
Let me tell you how stupid I am.
Okay.
We were sitting here doing this interview, and I had accepted the fact that your head was shaved and didn't even think about it very much.
Well, that's good.
Well, but
that
and
means
I
we
didn't
don't
even
have
ask,
to talk about it. Either.
I know, but I see there. Everybody else in America is looking at me, saying, "Why doesn't that idiot ask her why her head is shaved?" So now I'm doing it.
I just cut my hair because I wanted to cut my hair. You know, yeah. It's like, you know, I wear red knickers one day because I want to wear red knickers. You know,
and then black another day. We wouldn't call those knickers, though. What would we call those?
A photo shows Sinead smiling as she twirls wearing a long white dress. John Reynolds.
We got married at the Spiritualist Centre in Sloane Square, and we'd been going to the Spiritualist Centre a lot because, obviously, Sinead lost her mum, I'd lost my dad and a sister, and we were kind of trying to make some kind of spiritual connections if we could. It was a sort of a therapy for us in a way. We had an amazing time there, so we got married there. But it was brilliant. It was a great day.
A clip from the 1990 movie Hushabye Baby. Filmmaker Margot Harkin.
In 1989, we filmed Hushabye Baby in Derry. And it was in that film, Hushabye Baby, that Sinead made her acting debut. She came over with John. She was fairly newly married, I think. She brought her little son, Jake, who was just a toddler at that stage.
Of course, I only have eyes for licking lips.
Jesus Christ, Magella. We'll be barred, and it'll be your fault, Sloppy Ted, going on about what's-his-face.
In a clip from the movie, a serious Sinead dresses as a nun.
We were trying to contribute to the debate that was raging in Ireland at the time about abortion rights and women's sexuality and how women were being treated. And I think she had exactly the same feelings like so many thousands of other women, especially young women.
It's about a 15-year-old schoolgirl who gets pregnant and about, you know, the obvious trauma and awfulness that she goes through because of the fact that she's pregnant and the fact that teenage pregnancy is just like the worst thing that could possibly happen and people aren't very supportive about it in general. And girls are made to feel as if they're sluts, you know, or if they're some sort of whore, you know, for sleeping with somebody and things like that. And because of things like the church and the contraceptive laws and all that sort of thing and the abortion laws.
Filmmaker Margot Harkin.
In the 80s and 90s, and obviously the decades before that, women were treated abominably in Ireland. Women's lives were patrolled and investigated and surveilled and tampered with every minute of their lives. It was appalling.
Journalist Roisin Ingall.
There was the sense of being in this little backward place, you know, where the light wasn't really shining brightly and couldn't get contraception, you couldn't get condoms, that this was a big issue. You didn't talk about sex, and you certainly didn't talk about abortion.
It's quite a similar story to your own, isn't it?
No.
In that you had a baby when you were very young, and last time you told me that there were certain attitudes in Ireland.
Yeah, except I had a baby when I was 20 and I was living in London and I had enough money to get a nanny and I had a boyfriend who was living with me and I wasn't in school and I was in a society that doesn't look down on pregnancy as much as Ireland does, so I don't think you can compare that to a 15-year-old girl who has no money and no boyfriend and no support from anybody, you know what I mean? I think I was in very nice circumstances compared to those girls.
Archive footage of Sinead in a recording studio playing acoustic guitar.
When you put your first album out, you don't really expect anything to happen. You don't have any expectations in you. When you do that, you're not aware of the whole, you know, world of goodies and baddies to be discovered, you know. You know, I mean, I was quite taken aback by the whole thing and amused at the idea of me sitting there doing press conferences and things like that, because it was just like completely ludicrous. And at the time that I had my baby and put my album out, I was 20, you know, which is extremely young, and now I'm 23, which is still extremely young, and I'm still developing my personality, in inverted commas, and I'm still discovering things about myself and about the world, you know. So naturally, I'm not going to be the same as I was when I was 20.
When the album I Do Not Want, What I Haven't Got was finished, we took it into Nigel Grange in Ensign, and he said, "This is like reading somebody's diaries. I'm not putting it out." Sinead just said, "Well, that's it, you know, end of story." Didn't compromise it in any way.
Well, I'm far more proud of this album than I was of the last one. I feel that it's much more truly reflective of me than the last one was. And I've had much more involvement in it than I had in the last one.
The way she grew in confidence was something else. She's a powerful sexual being. I think she was enjoying playing with the gender roles. The kind of toughness of the leather jacket and the toughness of denim or the Dr. Martin boots or whatever it was that she was bringing at the time. There was always still this beautiful woman, beautiful girl inside of that. So she was playing with gender herself.
Filmmaker John Mabry.
She came to understand the nature of what we were doing with pop videos, and also, obviously, at a certain point, with a certain video, we came to understand just how much the videos could change the perception of the music and her as a musician.
Rushes from the Nothing Compares to You video shoot show Sinead wearing a long black coat, walking through a classical-style wintry park. John Reynolds.
The Nothing Compares to You video, she came back with all the rushes on a VHS and we stuck it into the video machine. I was watching it. And that's when I thought, wow, this is really, really special.
Creative director Jerry Stafford.
The video was shot both in studio and it was shot in the Parc Saint-Cloud, which is this beautiful 18th century park just outside of Paris.
Sinead walks across a frosty lawn.
The extraordinary close-up work that John did with the lighting camera woman, Dominique Le Rigoleur, who we chose particularly because we wanted a female to create a relationship between Sinead and the camera.
Sinead smiles in an outtake. John Mabry again.
In between takes, Sinead would click on some really heavy-duty dub reggae and light up a spliff and be bopping around the studio. We weren't in a kind of particularly somber mood.
looking into my monitor, looking down that lens, I saw right there this connection coming down the camera. It was like, oh, okay, this is really something else. It's not my direction, it's not the cinematography, it's entirely her.
If you don't identify emotionally with a song, you can't sing it.
In a close-up from the video, Sinead's cheeks are wet with tears.
I didn't know I was going to cry singing it. I didn't cry in the studio. It was just because it was a big eye on me in the form of a camera. Every time I sing the song, I think of my mother. I never stopped crying for my mother for Jesus. I couldn't face being in Ireland for 13 years. I never even called home. I just cut myself off entirely. But it took me, I would say, 25 years to stop crying. So, yeah, I was thinking of her, and I suppose my subconscious was thinking of that little girl that sat in the garden. I think it's funny that the world fell in love with me because of crying and a tear. I went and did a lot of crying, and everybody was like, oh, you crazy bitch. But actually, hold on, you fell in love with that tear. That was a mirror.
Another clip from the video. Tears trickle down Sinead's cheeks. Then she appears on the Late Late Show again.
Well done. The hair is growing.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit, a wee bit. How are you then?
I'm grand. I'm a bit tired.
A little bit tired, fine. Yeah. So we're told. Good to see you. Will you be number one on Monday?
I don't know. You're all very kind. I don't want to count my chickens. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You like that, though?
Half of me sort of says, oh, well, you know, it doesn't really make a difference, but then the other half is sort of going, oh, please, God, please.
Be nice.
We shouldn't even be thinking about this.
Shouldn't even be thinking about it. Okay, no. When will you know?
10 to 3 on Sunday afternoon. But I've got to try not to think about it.
The song went number one everywhere in the world, pretty much, and everything changed overnight.
And the winner is... Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor.
Sinead O'Connor.
I don't really know what to say except thank you very much. Yeah. Peace.
Sinead appears on the cover of magazines, then another award ceremony.
Sinead, nothing compares to you.
The level when Nothing Compares to You became a hit was extraordinary. It really was off the scale. She was the biggest thing. I mean, you think of artists like Billie Eilish now or Amy Winehouse, you know, that level of intensity that's on you. And also, if you're incredibly iconic in your look and your style and your passion, then there's a lot of focus on you.
I didn't realise how huge the single and the album were. I really didn't. Like, and I looked in some magazine the other day and it said in Spin that the record had been something like a fourth, like, biggest record in America, and I nearly dropped dead. I didn't have the slightest idea.
The single went to number one in America. She was suddenly a major act.
Guitarist Marco Peroni. Then a performance in front of a large, excited crowd.
Tour got bigger and bigger. Instead of theatres, it got into arenas and stadiums. She seemed to take it all in the stride. There were some days when she was sort of like, oh, this is a bit much. Most of the time, she seemed to enjoy it. There was obviously a feeling of like, oh, well, this is going to be great. It was going to be good anyway, but this is going to be really good.
Sinead performs live accompanied by a backing track. Bombs dropped from aircraft explode during Operation Desert Storm. President George Bush Sr. shakes hands with military personnel. space shuttle astronauts wave, then the space shuttle takes off. A clip from Twin Peaks. A young African-American man dances for the camera. Middle-aged women smile dressed in American red, white and blue. Miss USA waves as she wears a crown. A front page headline in the Miami Herald reads, "Rap album ruled obscene." A parental advisory sticker. A confrontation between police and public. Nirvana perform live. George Bush Sr. shakes hands with Mikhail Gorbachev after the signing of a treaty. Guitarist Marco Peroni.
About halfway through the tour, we did a place in New Jersey. It was an open-air venue. For some reason, they always play the national anthem before the main act. Sinead got to hear about it and said, "There's no way I'm not going on stage if you play the national anthem." So there was a bit of an argument between management and management of the venue, but in the end, the venue relented. They said, all right, if you don't want it played, you won't play it. And I thought, oh, this is going to be everywhere tomorrow. Going down to breakfast, you heard the immortal words, "Oh, God, have you seen the papers?"
First, the explosion. Then, the fallout.
Hi, 95.5 PLJ. It's Fast Jimmy. And you will hear no Sinead O'Connor on this radio station.
Sinead O'Connor is being shaved from the airwaves because of her recent refusal to perform in concert if the national anthem was played. With American soldiers on foreign soil poised for conflict, patriotism is running at fever pitch.
We decided Monday morning that since we played the national anthem on our station, to support the troops over in the Middle East, that she probably wouldn't welcome being played on our station either.
It was the wrong time, the wrong place, and the wrong way to throw a tantrum. Someone should just have said to her, within her own management, "Sinead, shut up.
If you don't like America, get the hell out. My opinion is she should go back to Ireland or wherever the hell she is from."
"Don't tell my country you can't play the national anthem. I didn't put the Marine green on to listen to some bald-headed Irish girl tell me I can't hear my national anthem."
She wants the money, the fame, and the glorification. Well, she's going to have to be sensitive to some issues.
One extreme patriot is Frank Sinatra, who said he would like to kick her ass. At his age, he couldn't lift his leg high enough to kick her ass, says Sinead's father, John O'Connor.
Claire Lewis of Sinead's management.
As soon as someone highlighted that it had to be played, she would say, "Well, you can't censor me. This is my show, and why are you telling me what to do?" America's the land of free speech, and they're telling her she's not allowed to have her free speech.
Issue number 3, the bald chick. What's with her head? Let's start with a chick. What gives, Q-Ball? I'm looking at you, I'm thinking 14 in the side pocket.
I can't believe you're talking about my hair with all the bloody starvation and the suffering in the world right now.
Come on, swing, baby, you're platinum. Forget the head. Put a bag over it and do your business.
I think that certainly the industry can be extremely patronising towards women. You're supposed to have long hair, wear push-up bras and lip gloss, you know, and shut up and sing. Maybe if I was a man, there wouldn't be such a fuss about it. You know what I mean? It's just not expected of women. I don't know. But then nothing about me particularly in people's minds conforms to what a woman should conform to. But I don't know if it's so much a conscious problem that they have because I'm a woman. You know, I think it's because I'm not a conformist on any level. You know what I mean?
Tell me about this row about the national anthem. Were you right to get into that?
I don't think it was a situation being wrong or right. It was a situation of I acted at the time in the way that I felt would be most true to myself. I didn't mean to offend anybody. I did it because I have a huge problem with the censorship movement that's happening in America at the moment. It has terrible implications. The idea that artists, you know, painters, photographers, musicians, poets and people like that are being told what they may and may not say and what they may and may not write about.
Where is that happening?
In America. In particular, among the black community, it's happening. So I have two problems with it. First of all, that I don't think censorship should happen at all to anybody. But secondly, I think that a lot of the time, there's a lot of white artists who are very offensive as well, and they don't get censored. So it leaves me thinking that it's a slightly racist problem as well. So, you know, if it happened now, I might have reacted in a different way. You know what I mean? I didn't realise that people would take such offence to it, and because I didn't mean offence, you know what I mean?
The problem is that a lot of people would say, well, you didn't not take the money.
You know, if they asked me for the money, I would gladly have given it to them.
You would? You would? All the money?
Absolutely.
All the money,
I don't perform or make records.
Can't go through life giving back the money.
I don't perform or make records or do anything in order to make money. It's not the thing that I hold most important in my life.
Well, I heard that she doesn't like Ireland, and she doesn't like the USA, so they're going to be handing out American flags, so we're going to wave it at her and see what she does.
Controversy surrounds her wherever she is.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Just because of who she is. I don't think she gets it fair. Because of the way she looks, I don't think people treat her fairly.
It's a very patriotic country, and a lot of people have been told that I have some sort of anti-American feeling. Which is very irresponsible on behalf of the media, because that does put a person in a situation where literally their life could be at risk. You know what I mean?
A headline, Sinead the She-Devil.
When the press started to attack her, that was really difficult. They arrived at the door in London, and Jake was with me, and he was only very young, and they started to fire questions, you know, while Jake was next to me, and I was absolutely furious.
We want the truth. We don't want lies. There must be no cover-up.
Shocked by the deaths that took place in Beijing.
She's always championed justice. You know, if something wasn't right, she would step in and try and do something about it.
The same old. Listen, this song that I heard, Black Boys on Mopeds, about the treatment of black people in England, very political, Sinead.
Mm. Well, you can't really talk about racism without being political, can you?
Yes, yeah. True, true.
We were living in Stoke Newington when she wrote that song. You know, it was around us, you know, that kind of police versus the black community. It was ugly at that point, particularly in that part of London.
I write songs about things that I feel strongly about. It's not consciously to write a political song or consciously to make a statement about anything. And I think that that's what every person's duty to themselves is to act on their feelings and to say when they think something is wrong. Mm. It doesn't matter whether they're, you know, a singer or whatever.
Yes, and take the consequences.
I imagine so.
I'm an Irish artist, and there's a tradition among Irish artists of being agitators and activists, you know, whether they're playwrights or poets. An artist's job is sometimes to create the difficult conversations that need to be had. And it's none of my business what anyone thinks of me when I do that.
A protest march.
The right to choose!
The right to choose an abortion. The right to information on where to obtain one. In Dublin's O'Connell Street, singer Sinead O'Connor speaks out against her country's stringent abortion laws.
Abortion will be legalized in this country very soon.
Let's have another referendum. Let only women of childbearing age vote for the right to choose their own destiny.
What I believe is that you cannot take away a person's right to choose. It is not a pro-abortion or an anti-abortion issue. The issue is the right to choose. The church deliberately distract us from that by making it into a either anti or for, you know what I mean? But it's not that. It's the right to choose your own destiny. It's none of anybody else's business, not your mother or your father or anybody else, or your priest.
Publicist Elaine Shock.
I never felt that Sinead would cave to any pressure, ever. Then she just seemed to become really controversial about everything.
2 weeks before the Grammys, O'Connor threw down the gauntlet to her peers, announcing she would not attend the ceremonies because the music industry was driven by greed and artists were not speaking out against the war in the Gulf.
It is the creative community that are driven by greed. That's why none of them are saying anything. because they're afraid their careers are going to be in jeopardy. It's why nobody has said anything about the war.
When Sinead refused to perform at the Grammys, I was under a lot of pressure to change her mind, as if that were even possible. It wasn't like threatening, but I felt that my career could certainly be in jeopardy and Sinead's as well. These were powerful people in the industry.
I didn't think that the powers that be were ready for her. Where she's from, artists had always stepped forward and said things, but maybe in different genres and not so much as a pop superstar. And Sinead O'Connor, when she was becoming a pop superstar.
Rapper Chuck D. Then Sinead in New York City.
Okay, so this is my favorite place in the universe, J. St. Mark's Place. All the Rastas live there, and all the Irish people live here, which is why I like it, because Rastas and Irish people should live together, since they're both the same. And this is Sinead.
The object of my game coming into the music business was I really saw it as something like a bit of a chess game. Could I get from one side of the board to the other and still be myself and still be true to my reasons for being in the music business? And also, I suppose, spiritually true to myself. Do you know what I mean? The music business can be a bit of a vampiric arena.
That's Charlie. The first one's Charlie and that's Charlton. Say hello to Jake.
Hi, Jake.
Bruce. Gary.
Yes.
Say hello to Jake.
Hi, Jake.
Hi, Gary.
Maybe we'll get to see you, Jake.
He's raving mad.
Hi, Jake. How you doing? Jake, how are you?
You can go around trying to please everyone as if you're in a popularity contest, and yeah, that might get you lots and lots of money, but that's not necessarily going to be keeping the contract that you made with yourself.
Sinead stands at a microphone in a recording studio.
That was the last one, wasn't it?
That's the last.
Okay, can we run from a bit before? Yeah.
I didn't want to fall into that trap then of, you know, the follow-up album to the number one single. So I was kind of buying myself some time, really, creatively speaking. Because you've had the hit record, all of a sudden you could go in there and tell them you want to make a record of farts, and they'll say, yeah, sure, okay.
Let's listen back and make sure we love this arrangement, okay?
I think there's a huge pressure from labels when an artist has a worldwide number one. And I think with the Am I Not Your Girl album, this was a great antidote, really, to what had happened. And it had the most amazing team of arrangers, musicians, and, of course, legendary Phil Ramone producing. It was just such a joy, that record.
John Reynolds, who is now shown playing drums on the recording. Then, in the music video for the song, Sinead uses sign language instead of miming.
We used to go out walking hand in hand. You told me all the big things you had planned.
I did love the record and I loved making it. Just astonishing being in a room with that band every day. It was just like, oh my God, I was quite intimidated actually. I was quite scared to open my mouth because the band were just so ridiculously brilliant. I couldn't see myself as being any way good.
There were things going on in my own life, things I was discovering that my mother had done that I didn't know about. And then I had come across an article about families who had been trying to lodge complaints against the church for sexual abuse and were being silenced. Basically, fucking everything I had been raised to believe was a lie, you know, that everything about the Catholic Church was a lie. You know?
Pope John Paul II acknowledges a huge crowd.
At the end of the line of bishops walked the Pope, and as the crowd noticed him, they broke into cheering and clapping.
I took two things out of my mother's house. One was her cookery book, and the next was a picture of the Pope, which had been on her bedroom wall.
Young people of Ireland, I love you.
He didn't fucking love me. I could fucking cry right now saying that. You know, it was such a lie. Now we know what a lie that was. He was so involved in covering up what happened to everybody. I had a right to fight that evil because I loved the church. I'm going to go on Saturday Night Live and I've got fuck all to lose because no one can do jack shit to me that hasn't been done already.
A caption reads, New York, USA, October 3rd, 1992. Busy streets. Publicist Elaine Shock again.
I had booked her on Saturday Night Live. Now, this was for her third record, which was Am I Not Your Girl? It's a great booking. The record was just coming out, and this would really help it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sinead O'Connor.
Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally
and permanently discredited.
The song is also very important. You know, it's a Rastafari song. It's a speech that the Emperor Haile Selassie had made at the United Nations, and then Bob Marley turned it into a song.
First class or second class citizens of any nation. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance to the color of his eyes, I've got to say
war. War in the East. War in the West. War up north, war down south, there's war, and the rumors of war. Until that day, there is no continent which will know peace. Children, children, fight. We find it necessary. We know we will win. We have confidence in the victory of good over evil. Fight the real enemy.
Having ripped up a photo of Pope John Paul II, she stares defiantly at the camera.
Nobody knows what to do. My blood has run cold. She blows the candle out, she goes off stage, she goes into her dressing room, and she's so happy. You know, she had pulled this off. And I had gone into the dressing room after her, and I said, you know, I can't get you out of this. And she said, you know what? I don't want you to.
What effect do you think this is going to have on your career, Sinead?
I don't know.
Do you care?
Well, it depends on what you mean by it. I don't know. You'd have to say what you meant.
Do you think what you've done will make you more popular with your fans, less popular with your fans, or will it just be something that Sinead O'Connor did in a rash moment?
Well, I can't really say. I don't know.
Are you prepared to accept the consequences, which you said don't seem to be negative, right, of what you're doing?
What consequences? Well, look at the alternative.
Sinead O'Connor is no stranger to controversy, a master of the shock tactics. But this time, some are questioning whether she went too far.
No response yet from the Pope, but church spokesmen say he will no doubt forgive Sinead O'Connor for her bout of Vatican bashing on NBC's Saturday Night Live.
Controversy for singer Sinead O'Connor as she strikes a sour note with Catholics.
NBC has been at pains to stress it doesn't condone what she did.
The network says O'Connor's tirade caught them off guard. NBC logged 1,000 complaint calls.
Her actions however, Saturday night were spontaneous, certainly unauthorized by NBC. And NBC was offended by what she did.
The Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights is pressuring record stores to stop selling recordings by O'Connor and her record company. During the lunch hour, they passed out leaflets urging customers to join their boycott. Some didn't need any encouragement.
I thought it was repulsive.
Anyone that sends us in
their tapes. We're going to chop up these tapes. Actually, we were just going to send them to her. Someone said, don't send her the tapes new. Break them up, because she'll sell them again. So we're going to break them up and put them in a trunk and have someone deliver them to her in Ireland, wherever she may be.
I would have grabbed her by her eyebrows.
Sinead O'Connor, and so on.
Just don't like that she tore up a picture of the Pope.
Oh, no. Sinead O'Connor is completely a robot brain. She has messages. She's like a Victorian, okay? She has messages which she slaps onto art like labels.
But I'll tell you one thing. She was very lucky it wasn't my show. Because if it was my show, I would have gave her such a smack.
Sinead O'Connor, whose big theme is child abuse, all right? Comes from child abuse.
In the case of Sinead O'Connor, child abuse was justified.
John Reynolds.
I got a little bit worried, you know, when things were going really badly in the press for her. It was a terrible time for us and just created this hatred. It was unbelievable.
I had fan letters with death threats to myself, death threats to Sinead, and one day I took in a sack load of letters that were directly threatening either to her or to me or any of our team.
I was watching it with some friends as it happened, and we were all like applauding and cheering, and we're like, feminist performance art on TV, when does that ever happen?
I can't sit here and tell you that I was all like, oh no, Sinead O'Connor's an icon, she's ahead of her time. I don't think I was saying that then. I think I probably was joining in, oh God, what's she doing now? There was this idea that she was a bit of a joke.
Fight the real enemy!
When she does a concert in New York City, if she has the guts to ever do a concert in New York City again, after one of her songs, I'm going to jump up on stage and tear up a photo of Uncle Fester.
Bob Dylan's 30th anniversary concert, October 16th, 1992.
You enjoy shocking people?
No, but I enjoy a good debate.
Did you realize the consequences at the time?
No, I don't think it's a good idea to talk about it tonight, here, tonight.
So you don't want to talk about it at all?
Some other time I'll talk to you about it.
But obviously you don't have any regrets?
No, absolutely not.
I'm real proud to introduce this next artist whose name's become synonymous with courage and integrity. Ladies and gentlemen, Sinead O'Connor.
Stage and the audience start making this mad noise where half of them are booing and half of them are cheering. And it's the fucking weirdest noise I've ever heard in my life, and it makes me want to puke.
As she stands at the microphone with head bowed, compere Kris Kristofferson approaches her and says, "Don't let the bastards get you down." "I'm not down," she replies.
My song that I was supposed to sing at Madison Square Garden was I Believe in You. The song was to be sung in a whisper, and I knew that I couldn't because I wouldn't be heard. I would have been drowned out. I couldn't have that. Are you going to stand by me was almost what I felt God was saying to me. Are you going to fucking stand by me, or are you going to pussy out here and walk off stage?
She signals to the band to stop playing.
Okay, turn this up. Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war until there's no longer first-class or second-class citizens of any nation. Until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, I've got to say war. Until the basic human rights I say war. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime which holds all of us through child abuse, yeah! Child abuse, yeah! Subhuman bondage has been toppled, utterly destroyed. Everywhere is war!
Musician Kathleen Hanna.
Everything kind of coalesced into that moment. Someone who grew up in a household of abuse and rejection, then being rejected by what probably felt like the whole entire world, re-traumatizing her in front of the world, it made me feel demoralized as a woman.
People that would boo Sinead O'Connor, what were they doing at a Bob Dylan concert? She's taken quite a beating in the world because the world does not take kindly to having its program interrupted. The smooth flow of entertainment must not be interrupted.
A 1993 open letter to the Irish Times.
My name is Sinead O'Connor. I'm learning to love myself. I am deserving. I deserve to be treated with respect. I deserve not to be treated like dirt. I deserve to be listened to. My name is Sinead O'Connor. I am a woman. I have something to offer. I am and have always been carrying a lot of grief for my lost childhood and for the effects of its horror and violence on my life. I find it hard to be myself, to show my feelings. To get the joy, I need to release the pain which is blocking me. If I do not do this, I will not survive. I was angry before because I was frightened, but I know that if you could really listen, you'd see that we do not know what we are doing when we mock the expression of human feeling. When we scoff at the sound of our children's keening, there is a mirror into which we are not looking. There's no way I'm going to shut my mouth. I'm a battered child, and the whole bloody world is going to know about it, the same as they're going to know about every other battered child. They're not going to be able to shut us up just because they don't want to hear about it.
Musician Peaches.
We all have mental health issues on what level, and it's very important for us to recognize that. And I think that's something that Sinead O'Connor did way before anybody else.
I was always being crazied by the media, made out to be crazy. I don't blame anybody for thinking I was crazy or for hating me for it or whatever, because they didn't know, and it was a crazy idea. I mean, this bitch is saying that priests are raping children. I mean, Jesus Christ. Of course it seemed crazy to them.
Sinead was put into isolation. She was still making great music, still making great records, but we didn't hear them and we didn't see them. In those days, if the press weren't talking about you, if you weren't on the radio, if you weren't on TV screens, you might as well have not existed, which is what happened with Sinead. She just disappears.
Musician Skin.
I have about a 10-year period. I don't remember much because it suddenly became a free-for-all for everybody around me, personally and publicly, to treat me like shit, basically. They didn't like what they saw in the mirror. I understand that now, but when I was younger, I was just hurt.
Dr. Sinead Kennedy of Maynooth University, Dublin.
The willingness to tell her story, to share her personal pain, her struggles, to share them with Ireland and with the world, I think has given people the courage to do the same.
Prime Minister of Ireland, Enda Kenny.
On behalf of this state, the government and our citizens, deeply regret and apologise unreservedly to all those women for the hurt that was done to them, for any stigma they suffered as a result of the time they spent in the Magdalen Laundry. Today we live in a very different country with a very different consciousness and a very different awareness. An Ireland where we have more compassion, more empathy, more insight, more heart. We do because at last we are learning those terrible lessons. We do because at last we're giving up our secrets.
In
Ireland, it's being called a quiet revolution and a victory for women. The once conservative nation voted yes to repeal a constitutional ban on abortion.
I think Ireland's coming so far in the last 10 years, and I think it's just really shown that we're not so influenced by the church as much anymore.
Wherever there's that righteous anger of a woman now who is making a difference, who's changing things, who's standing up and being courageous, there's where the little sparks of Sinead are.
Journalist Roisin Ingall, then archive footage of Me Too marches.
We are seeing the rights that people fought for being pulled back, being diminished. And to look at the power of speaking out, and she is the absolute epitome of what that power is. We need to keep showing how effective it is and how important it is.
A lot of artists that came after her that were able to say and speak their mind and spill their soul. She broke the ice for a whole decade or two decades of artists after her.
Rapper Chuck D. Footage of SNL performing in October 2020. A backdrop behind them reads, "Protect Black Women." Then an aerial view of St. Peter's Basilica, the Vatican.
A government inquiry last year found some Irish bishops put their church's reputation before the interests of their flock, actively covering up clerical child abuse for 30 years. But the scandals go far beyond Ireland and touch the Vatican directly. Last week, it was alleged that Pope Benedict, then known as Cardinal Ratzinger, had prevented the church trial of an American paedophile priest in the 1990s.
The church in Ireland must acknowledge before the Lord and others the serious sins committed against defenceless children.
Kathleen Hanna.
Sinead O'Connor, as an artist, forged her own path in a world that just was not ready for her. This young upstart with the most beautiful voice you can imagine showed up and just rocked the shit out of the horse cart. I don't want to see her as a martyr because she's a three-dimensional human being. She makes mistakes. She's a weirdo. She's great. She's a lot of different things. She did not deserve what she got.
I regret that people treated me like shit. And I regret that I was so wounded already that really, really killed me and hurt me, you know? They all thought I should be made a mockery of for throwing my career down the drain. I never set out to be a pop star. It didn't suit me being a pop star. So I didn't throw away any fucking career that I wanted. Didn't change my attitude. I wasn't sorry. I didn't regret it. I was the proudest thing I've ever done as an artist. They broke my heart and they killed me. But I didn't die. They tried to bury me. They didn't realize I was a seed.
A recent performance by Sinead.
Thank you for hearing me. 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 Thank you for loving 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 me.
Which captions read, Since 1993, Sinead has released 7 further albums to critical acclaim and toured extensively. Nothing Compares to You remains a global hit single, loved and continually discovered by fans since its release. And for not The Prince Estate denied use of Sinead's recording of Nothing Compares to You in this film. A caption reads, "Thank you, Sinead," in loving memory of Sinead O'Connor, 8th of December 1966 to 26th of July 2023. The end. Audio described by Kieran McLaughlin. Thank you for hosting.